Here's what I want you to do. I want you to keep your eye on the economic big picture because there are a whole lot of moving parts out there. From American Public Media, this is Market Play. In New York City today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the 14th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been, as I said, a big picture kind of week this week, economy-wise. So we are going to get right to it. The 5 days gone by in five, maybe five and a half, actually, live radio minutes. Catherine Rappel is with the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, I'm going to start with you since you're actually here in the studio with me in New York and top of mind. With the caveat that we're going to have Tracy Samuelson coming on and talking about the internal gearings of the Chinese economy in a minute, I want to ask you whether, with the news today that the Chinese are going to pull back on some auto tariffs that they raised in response to the president's tariffs, and also they're buying more soybeans now, not a lot, but some more, do you suppose the president was right in his tariff war that maybe he's going to be able to get the Chinese to do what he wants?
I think this is, if anything, just a de-escalation. It is not actually a sign that China is going to give in on any of the more significant structural changes that we actually need them to make.
Which are big.
There are things like stopping forced technology transfer, respecting foreign companies' IP rights, no longer having these big subsidies for their state-owned enterprises. These are much more significant things than buying a few more soybeans. And the fact that they're just sort of bringing us back to maybe where we were a few months ago doesn't necessarily mean that we have achieved progress. I think one of the challenges for achieving progress, besides the fact that the things that we need China to do are so ambitious, has to do with the fact that Trump himself has been very inconsistent in his messaging for what he actually wants. Rather than focusing on these structural issues, he's talking about the deficit, which is not what's significant here.
Right. Although it's actually been a while since we've heard him talk about the deficit, but that's a whole other interview. Sudeep, let me ask you, in essence, the same question and point out in asking it that we're on a 90-day clock here. I think the 1st of March is the deadline. Are we going to get there? I mean, will there be real progress?
The 1st of March will arrive somehow. Look, it's
ask
never
a better
good
question,
when
God.
Yeah, when the two largest economies in the world are fighting over core pieces of their economies. It's just not good. Both countries, U.S. and China, have huge influence over their neighbors. They have knock-on effects. And obviously right now the U.S. has considerably more cushion to deal with any pain that comes from a trade war than the Chinese do. But all of that can change quickly. And usually these kinds of conditions create the bad economic backdrop for some other kind of shock to come in and devastate everything. And then you look and see, oh, you had a perfect storm and here are all the problems that came up. And we don't know what that perfect storm will entail, but this is not a good environment to be fighting like this.
Well, to that end, Catherine, Wall Street Journal survey of economists this week, 47% of them said trade is the biggest problem going into 2019, the biggest threat. Only 7%, contrary to what the president says, say the Fed is the biggest economic threat.
Well, that's because there is a huge threat looming as a result of this trade war, right? You have American companies having to pay higher prices because we've put tariffs on inputs that they buy. Mm-hmm. So if you're a manufacturer, you know, your cost of production went up. You have markets closed off to soybean farmers, for example, but lots of other farmers and manufacturers besides.
Right.
And then beyond that, you have the lingering uncertainty about how all of this stuff is going to get resolved. So if you're a company and you're trying to figure out where to invest, you know, you just have all of this uncertainty hanging over you. So it's totally reasonable for people to point at the big elephant in the room, the trade war, and say, hey, you know, that stampede could cause a lot of damage.
Sudeep, I want to turn super quickly, I'm talking like 45 seconds-ish, to the Federal Reserve. They meet next week, lots of anticipation. Make me care.
The Fed is trying and trying very hard to not make you care, to make you think that they're boring,
right.
That they're going to manage the economy, they're going to keep everything smooth, they're trying to look through stock market volatility, they're trying to look through the ups and downs. And from the Fed's perspective, things are actually looking pretty good. Despite 2 years of chest thumping over a trade war, we have very low unemployment, decent GDP growth. Things are actually pretty good from the Fed's perspective, and they just don't want to be the ones to screw it up. And so they're going to hope that whatever they do next week will not screw it up in any way.
Let me stay actually in Washington, Sudeep, with you. And I want to spend just a little bit of time on the politics of the economy in 2019. Talk of a shutdown this week at the White House. The Dems will be in control come the 3rd of January. What will that mean, if anything, for what the Congress and the president do on this economy?
Well, the taste that we got this week is that they're certainly not going to sit down and come together and or even hug it out and move ahead on any of this stuff. They might make some tweaks or on economic policy around the edges here and there. Looks like their attention is focused elsewhere. But you've got two leaders in Congress coming up who would probably love to cut some deals, but they've got very difficult groups to handle. Nancy Pelosi is dealing with dozens of members who are salivating over the taste of power for the first time, wanting to take down Donald Trump. And Chuck Schumer, it seems like half of his Democratic colleagues are salivating over the 2020 Democratic nomination to take down Donald Trump. And so that's going to be the focus of this, is how does whatever Democrats do fit into the anti-Trump moment for Democrats broadly? And that is going to suck all of the air out of the Capitol.
Catherine,
or put same more basic, into it. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Same basic question to you, right? What does 2019 bring us?
Well, I think we've seen unified partisan control of government, and they were not able to get anything done, with the exception of a major tax cut, really. When you have divided government, I think we should expect even less to happen, which, you know, maybe I guess is okay unless we hit a recession, unless we have some sort of major crisis, whether it's provoked by the trade war or some other shock, and you actually need functional
political will, and you need
a president who's able to unify warring parties to get them to come together to do things that may not be in their short-term political interest, which is what we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. And you need a functional government, even if there isn't a crisis, but there is just a mild recession, so that they can, you know, deal with a stimulus package or what have you. So I'm quite worried about the political picture if things go south. If we stay as we are, you know, maybe it'll be okay.
We shall see. Catherine Pell at the Washington Post, Sadiq Reddy down in Washington at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. Wall Street today, which we did not get to, actually. It was not, shall we say, a winner. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We did a quick pass at the Chinese economy, Catherine and Sudeep and I, on kind of a macro level. But there are some things going on that deserve a closer look. As I said, specifically, data out this morning showing slowing growth in retail sales over there and some industrial production slowdowns as well. How much Chinese factories are producing is at three-year lows. In other words, it kind of does look like growth in the world's second biggest economy is continuing to slow down. Some of that is to be expected as the Chinese economy matures and changes, as it's been doing. Some of it, though, not so predictable, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
For a while now, China's been on this journey.
What you're referring to is Xi Jinping's call to transition from high-speed growth to high-quality growth.
Andrew Coughlin is a China researcher with the Eurasia Group.
During that transition, there was this understanding that you'd see slowing growth, which we have seen.
But recently, the Chinese economy has slowed more than its leaders have intended.
What has happened in this year is a misstep to some extent, a tightening of credit that led to a slowdown in the wrong parts of the economy in a way that's far more worrying than the structural slowdown that happens as part of economic transition.
Patrick Chovanec, chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management, says credit isn't getting to the parts of the Chinese economy where it'd be most useful.
What they're not doing is financing things that are difficult, but potentially more rewarding. And that could be logistics or healthcare or agriculture or services or new consumer brands. All kinds of areas where there is potential for growth in the Chinese economy.
Chovanec says these are longstanding problems for China, but they're getting renewed attention now.
A lot of people are focused on China now because of the trade war or conflict between the United States and China.
Thing is, he says so far, the trade dispute isn't what's weighing on Chinese growth.
It's not because of the impact directly of trade. It's because all of a sudden people are looking more closely at the Chinese economy and realizing that not all is well.
Chovanec says inside and outside China, there's broad recognition of the problems the country faces. But fixing them is another story. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The luxury goods conglomerate LVMH, purveyor of brands the likes of Louis Vuitton, Dom Perignon Champagne, and Christian Dior, announced an acquisition today. The company is going to spend a bit more than $3 billion to buy Belmonde, which owns luxury hotels, including the Cipriani in Venice, and also the Orient Express Railroad Service. So here is the core competency question, if you will. Why is a company known for its luxury goods getting into luxury travel? Marketplace's Ben Bradford is on that one.
Riley Adams is a 29-year-old investment advisor who says this Christmas, he and his wife aren't giving each other traditional gifts.
I think both of us just couldn't really think of anything that would make us any happier by buying like a physical gift.
Instead, the Adamses are spending their Christmas money on a trip to San Francisco to stay at the Fairmont Hotel, specifically to see
this supposedly famous gingerbread house exhibit.
When the owner of Louis Vuitton starts buying hotels, it's to attract customers like Riley, analysts say. He wants to go to events, restaurants, or foreign countries more than he wants to buy an expensive bag.
You just want to have that lasting memory. And I feel that's much more rewarding and satisfactory than a physical gift.
Spending on experiences has grown four times faster than spending on goods, per a McKinsey & Company report from last year. Report author Sophie Marchessault says it's a generational change.
On experiences, millennials outspend the previous generation, so both the Gen X as well as the boomers.
LVMH saw double-digit sales growth this year, but retail consultant Milton Pedraza of the Luxury Institute says its new hotels and trains are a smart look ahead.
If they want to remain viable in the future, they need to start investing in, call them experiential and service brands.
And those brands are beating goods thanks to smartphones, according to some industry watchers. That's how Riley Adams will share and remember his experience in San Francisco.
There are going to be lots of pictures.
Today, gingerbread houses. Tomorrow, maybe a Louis Vuitton hotel. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Sort of at the other end of the luxury scale, there's a food chain story this week. McDonald's says it plans to cut the amount of antibiotics that are fed to the cattle that it turns into hamburgers. Ranchers feed them the drugs to keep them healthy, but it's not really so great for people for a whole lot of reasons. McDonald's and other chains have already cut down on the use of antibiotics in the chicken they serve, but really, this is a story of scale. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports on McDonald's and the global beef industry.
This isn't about keeping antibiotics out of McDonald's hamburgers. In the U.S., at least, the Food and Drug Administration sets limits on drug residue in meat. Instead, McDonald's says this is about preventing antibiotic resistance. And the fast food chain is taking a slow, deliberate approach. The first step, it's going to ask its suppliers, cattle farmers, how they're using antibiotics. Peter Soleil, an analyst at BTIG, says McDonald's will probably also ask farmers how long this is going to take.
How quickly can we move? You know, how quickly can you guys reduce antibiotics in your supply chain?
In 2020, McDonald's will set some goals. Then, 2 years later, it'll start tracking progress. Once this effort really gets going, it could affect the entire global beef industry, because cattle farmers depend on their contracts with the fast food chain. John Gordon is a restaurant analyst at Pacific Management Consulting Group.
Many suppliers would like to do business with McDonald's. So what it means over time is that there will be more growers producing more antibiotic-free livestock.
The McDonald's plan is probably going to cost farmers money, because if they cut back on antibiotics, more of their cattle could get sick and die. And Peter Soleil at BTIG says those farmers will pass that cost on to McDonald's.
If it's changing the entire supply chain, it's going to be more expensive beef, and McDonald's has to raise prices to account for that.
This is the second time this year that McDonald's has shaken up its beef supply chain. In March, it started using fresh beef instead of frozen in its quarter pounders. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I had not used any of my FSA up until December.
Use it or lose it. But first, let's do the numbers. Wow, totally thought it would be the Wawa's today. I don't know. Maybe the Dow dropping 496 points, 2% doesn't get you there. 24,100 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 159 points. That's more than 2.25%, finished at 69.10. The S&P 500 slipped 50 points, about 1.9%, 25.99 there. For the week, the Dow off 1.1%. The NASDAQ 0.8% lower. The S&P 500 fell 1.25%. We talked about LVMH buying the high-end hotelier Belmond, but investors snatched the mint off LVMH's pillow today. I love that. Dropped at 1.5%. Marriott International, which owns Ritz-Carlton and St. Regis brands, tarnished 1%. McDonald's, Mickey D's off 1.6% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace. You make financial decisions every day, from minor transactions to major life choices. And that's why Marketplace covers the economy from so many different angles, connecting the dots between the micro and the macro. As a nonprofit organization, we depend on individuals like you to help us provide trustworthy news that adds value to your life. If you're not yet a Marketplace investor, please contribute today at marketplace.org, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a thing that happens in dating nowadays, so I'm told, I should be clear here, that's called ghosting. You're seeing someone, and then all of a sudden, they're just gone. No text, no call, no nothing. And now, apparently, it's happening at work. Danielle Paquette wrote about workers ghosting from their jobs in the Washington Post. Disappearing, the headline says, like bad dates. Danielle, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
So talk to me about workplace ghosting, right? I mean, it's a phenomenon in other parts of life, but people just leaving their jobs cold? What is that?
That's right. This idea actually came from the Fed's Beige Book. Economists had noted that people were just walking off the jobs, never returning, never responding to phone calls or texts. And they've identified this as ghosting, which is a term we usually use in our dating life. And I'm hearing it's on the rise because the job market is so tight. Opportunities are everywhere. And if you're not happy about where you are, you can pretty much just take off and land somewhere better.
So let's be clear about this. It's literally just taking off without a word, without an email, without an anything. You just don't show up.
Yes, I've heard, since the story published, actually, I've heard from hundreds of people who've shared even more fascinating tales, who tell me, look, you know, my boss made me angry that day, and I went out for lunch, and then I just drove off.
What? Okay, who does that?
Apparently lots of people. You know, there's not a ton of data on economic ghosting, but I talk to large global staffing firms who tell me this kind of behavior is on the rise by as much as 20%.
Wow.
Some people just want to avoid those awkward interactions. Others say, hey, I know if I put in my 2 weeks' notice, they would just escort me off the premises and I need that money.
Is this something that, like, and I'm going to get yelled at for saying this, but is this a millennials thing, younger millennials? Because you're not going to find, you know, too many mature workers in this environment taking off, right?
You know, you'd think that because ghosting is a part of the millennial vocabulary.
Right.
It appeared in the dictionary in 2016. But I'm hearing from workers of all ages, and particularly older workers who are fed up with how their rights, their pay, their benefits packages have just dwindled over time, you know, as power has shifted in favor of employers and the relationship between employee and employer has weakened. You see more people work as contractors than full-time staffers, and they just don't have that same tie to their manager that they might have in the past.
Well, so granted that this is mostly anecdotal, but on the same on the flip side of that coin, you know, if the Fed's noticing it and putting it in its beige book, then it's a tangible, real thing. Do you suppose this will somehow lead to higher salaries, greater protections for some of these workers? I mean, are companies going to realize that maybe there are some things they can do in their power to fix the ghosting issue?
Some companies that have already struggled with ghosting for quite a while are trying to prevent it by offering wage increases over time. You know, stick with us and you'll see a 2% raise next year and a 2% raise after that. And so workers have more incentive to stay, watch their pay grow. Other firms are offering more on-job training so that people see a future at that firm. Maybe they can step up in some way. They have an opportunity that might not be available to them elsewhere yet.
Last question, then I'll let you go. Have you ever done this?
Absolutely not. But journalism's a little different.
Yes, it is.
Word of mouth is important.
Yeah, reputation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Danielle Paquette, she's a business writer at the Washington Post. Danielle, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The end of the calendar year brings with it some economic deadlines, transactions you might want to make for tax purposes for one thing. Also, healthcare, specifically something called flexible spending accounts. Your company sets aside a chunk of your paycheck before taxes are taken out, and then you can use that money to pay certain medical expenses. Since you're spending pre-tax dollars, it's a way to get a bit more healthcare for your money. But FSAs are also kind of a gamble, right? Because if you don't use the money you set aside, you lose it. So with an eye firmly on the healthcare calendar, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains how FSAs came to be the way they are today.
Maybe around this time of year, you are checking your flexible spending account. And maybe you are like first-time user Celeste Smith.
I had not used any of my FSA up until December.
Someone randomly mentioned it, and so she checked her balance. With a flexible spending account, you can sometimes carry over $500 into the next year. But for the most part, if you don't use it, you'll lose it.
I looked this morning, saw the amount of money that I had in there.
As in all of it, $800.
And within 2 hours, I had booked and attended an eye doctor appointment. I have an appointment with a frames specialist later today, and then probably end up going and figuring out what other little things like sunscreen and, you know, what over-the-counter medication can I get with that.
Critics of FSAs point out that, you know, for people who have thousands of dollars that they haven't used in December, it often leads to a spike in unnecessary medical care expenditures.
Rick Lindquist is co-author of The End of Employer-Provided Health Insurance. Around 8% of people leave money in their FSAs, on average about $172. There are actual online stores whose sole purpose is to find ways to get people to spend their remaining FSA money at the end of the year. So what will happen to the money if you do not spend it?
What happens to it is it goes back to your employer.
Paul Fronston is with the Employee Benefit Research Institute.
It's theirs to keep, and they can use it to offset any losses.
And there are losses, because when you sign up for an FSA and you tell your employer to take out like $1,200 from your paycheck over the year, the employer has to make all of that available on day one of the new year, before a cent has actually been taken out of your paycheck.
Yeah, I could say get a LASIK surgery on January 2nd, submit the receipt on January 3rd, get reimbursed on the 4th, and quit my job on the 5th. If that happens, my employer is out $1,200.
The leftover money can also be used to pay for the administration of the plan. But why are there all these rules around FSAs at all?
What survives today is not logical because it wasn't really designed to exist the way it now exists.
Dallas Salisbury is president of the Long-Term Care Quality Alliance. He's been in the benefits industry for almost 5 decades. He says FSAs started in the late 70s because a group of major employers in the country wanted to get out of paying for all of their employees' health insurance. The Revenue Act of 1978 was passed, allowing this to happen. The idea was, at the time, if you give people FSAs, they would choose high-deductible insurance plans that were cheaper for their employers.
In hindsight, that package proved unsuccessful.
Employees ended up demanding that employers pay most of their health insurance costs. They took the tax-deductible FSAs, and the government became concerned it was losing too much tax revenue on these early FSAs. Congress came up with the use-it-or-lose-it rule in 86.
It was purposefully put there to annoy and to limit use.
The IRS made rules about what expenses qualify and what don't. Obamacare added even more rules. You have to keep receipts and fill out annoying forms. But all these years later, there is still an entire industry around using up FSA money and administering FSA plans. And Americans are still saving money by using them. They put at least $40 billion into FSAs each year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We have a guide for all things FSA on our website. The important stuff, too, how to calculate how much you ought to put in and what you can spend that money on. Check it out, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, a tangent of sorts to the political news of the week, Flynn and Cohen et al. Special Counsel Robert Mueller released his latest statement of expenditures today. From May 2017, when he was appointed, to the end of September this year, the Justice Department says Mueller's Russia investigation has cost taxpayers just about $25 million. There is, though, a line item I'm curious about. For the 6 months ended in September, the special counsel spent $779, and this is the actual line item, on transportation of things. What do you suppose that is? All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 2% today. The Nasdaq down more than 2.25%. The S&P 500 down 1.9%. Lousy week overall, down about 1% or so across the board. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you next week. Have a good weekend, everybody. All right, we're back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.